You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Santa Fe County. If you've been looking to go solar in your home, Santa Fe County's Sustainability Office wants you to know that the 30% federal tax incentives are only available until the end of 2019. So if you've been thinking about going solar, now's the time to do it. And if you're not sure where to start, start with Santa Fe County's Office of Sustainability, where you can get a free impartial consultation to help demystify the process and help you calculate upfront just how big a system you might need. Contact them at 992-9832 or visit santafecountynm.gov/publicworks. And the Radio Cafe is also brought to you by Morningstar Senior Living, which is building its newest community on Pacheco Street in Santa Fe. They'll be providing independent living, assisted living, and memory care to make sure that you and your loved ones can live fully and vibrantly in a safe environment. You can reach Morningstar Senior Living at 505-919-7989. That's 505-919-7989, or go to morningstarseniorliving.com and let them know that you heard about it on the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you'd like to sponsor the Radio Cafe, please contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can reach him at 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican, and all that info is there. And now to our program. We're going to be talking today to the director of the Indian Arts Research Center at the School for Advanced Research. And I want to say before we get into our program that if you live in the Santa Fe area and have never been to SAR, the School for Advanced Research, you've got a great treat ahead of you. It's on a campus that was once the estate of a pair of wealthy sisters, the White Sisters, and it's exquisitely beautiful and peaceful, both the buildings and the landscaping, and there's lots of amazing stuff going on over there. SAR is an institute for anthropologists and archaeologists, and it also houses the Indian Arts Research Center, which is both a center for the study of Indian arts and a collection of art, both historical and also new work by living artists. The center's director is Brian Vio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons that we're here today is because the Indian Arts Research Center is celebrating its 40th anniversary coming up fairly soon, and we're going to be talking about that in a moment. But let's talk about this center. It is an extraordinary place. It has a collection of Indian art that includes over 12,000 pieces, ceramics, textiles, two-dimensional work, baskets, jewelry, all kinds of things. How did it come into being?
Well, the School for Advanced Research was established 111 years ago, this, which was the School for American Archaeology. In the earlier years, Edgar Lee Hewitt, who was the central figure in establishing SAR, was also involved in a number of other initiatives here in Santa Fe, including the development of the Museum of New Mexico Network, and specifically the New Mexico Museum of Art downtown. He and others who all shared these interests were also concerned about the future of the Pueblos in New Mexico. You know, there was this thinking at this time that at some point in the future, Pueblo communities or tribes throughout the country would eventually vanish. And so based on this kind of paradigm of salvage collecting, they set out on a project to collect Pueblo ceramics that were being made at that time. And this was in the early 1920s. So Edgar Lee Hewitt and a few of his close friends all contributed towards a fund, and they established what was called the Pueblo Pottery Fund, again with that idea that they would go into the Pueblos of New Mexico and purchase and or commission works by Pueblo potters. Now, pottery was being extracted or had been extracted from the Pueblos before the 1920s when the Pueblo Pottery Fund was established. So there was already an experience that was had by Pueblo people in the late 1800s and into the early 1900s when either federal agents or independent archaeologists, ethnographers were coming into the Pueblos and extracting not only ceramics but a number of other materials. It's estimated that in the late 1800s, the Pueblo where I'm from, which is Acoma, that as many as 6,000 ceramics left the Pueblo.
Now, when you say extracted, is that like a euphemism for stealing, or what does that mean?
Well, I wouldn't go far as saying stealing, though there was some pot hunting. There were some excavations of ancestral Puebloan sites that occurred. But the material culture of the living Pueblos at that time, were being coerced really into releasing these materials and information. So by the time the Pueblo Pottery Fund was established, I think people in the Pueblos were very guarded, very protective of their lands, of course. But it was also during this time that early tourism initiatives were evolving. Not in any real formal sense, but non-tribal members were still accessing the communities. And there were a number of potters and other artists who had ventured out and saw the opportunity to make a living selling their art and crafts. And of course, by then, there were relationships that had been established between neighbors who surrounded the pueblos, but also by or with a number of scholars and others, collectors, very early collectors, who already had established ties with communities, and in some cases, specifically with tribal artisans or tribal leaders. So back to the Pueblo Pottery Fund initiative, the folks who were involved knew that families had private collections, if you will. So some of these things were also purchased by the Pueblo Pottery Fund. And that's probably one of the significant differences here is that the folks of the Pueblo Pottery Fund had the intent on purchasing the materials.
Was it an ethics issue for them?
I hope so. I mean, I believe that the Pueblo Pottery Fund was based on this idea that there needed to be some compensation. I don't know that they actually took the time to explain the intent behind this collecting, but I think there was a level of respect that was offered. And others might argue that there wasn't. Some tribal members were very protective. There are stories at my pueblo about kind of, intentionally misleading folks who were coming in and asking the questions again.
Oh, here come the anthropologists. Here come the collectors. Let's just tell them, stories.
Right. Or let's sell them this particular item.
And tell them it's, yeah.
Right. And so I think in order for the Pueblos to participate in this collecting initiative, they also had to establish their own internal protocols for that engagement. So the Pottery Fund initiative was quite successful. If you visit our vaults, you will see the extent to which they collected. So they were successful at purchasing materials that were being made at that time, but also older materials that were perhaps family heirlooms.
The original idea that we better collect this stuff because these people will not be here someday, that has not turned out, thank goodness, to be the reality that happened. We're living in a place where there are lots of vibrant, living, robust Indian cultures, and yet they have often historically been ignored by the very museums that collected them and the collectors and the people who show their work and so on. You here at the Indian Art Research Center are very active in changing that through a process of setting up real dialogue and listening. What does that look like?
There have been a number of initiatives over the last maybe 30 years that have either mandated institutions through federal policy or perhaps initiatives developed by private institutions and even collectors and galleries where information was needed or desired, more information about the collections that they steward or had in their private collections. I think what really brought some change was the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. One mandate within that policy is consultation. Now, consultation was not clearly defined in the law, but it was a mandate. And when some institutions were preparing for engagement with source communities, after having provided inventories of their collections to these communities, there really wasn't a strategy for achieving the collaboration or the consultation.
So just to back up for a second, let's say a museum owns a set of Indian pots that are from Acoma Pueblo. They are mandated to consult with people from Acoma Pueblo as to what these are, like information gathering. Like, what was that?
Well, so the whole idea behind NAGPRA is that an institution who has in their possession objects of cultural patrimony, human remains, associated funerary objects, some items with eagle feathers, were mandated to prepare inventories. They did not include general collections of, say, ceramics or textiles. And so the consultation process is a result of a tribe making a claim to those materials, those ancestral remains. And there was a lack of preparation on the part of the federal agents and on the part of the tribes, because this really had never happened before. And this, quote, consultation, unquote, was defined in many ways. For some institutions, it was sending a letter or making a phone call, and the consultation box was checked.
And if they got the voicemail, that was the consultation?
Right. So based on this experience with NAGPRA, there were some tribes who had the capacity to, and who made the commitment. Some tribes who did engage were learning a lot. Some of those tribes also had relationships with SAR. Thankfully, we don't have a collection of human remains, but we know that there may be materials that could potentially be culturally sensitive items.
So the idea here is you've got these things that were made by a group of people whose descendants are still here, who presumably know a great deal about this work, about meanings, about materials, about all kinds of things that collectors and curators might not have any idea about. And let's get a dialogue going to establish mutual understanding. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, that's accurate. But the other part of that is we want to also give some ownership back to the source community.
Right.
We want to collaborate with the source community as we think about the future of this collection, the stewardship of this collection over the long term, access to this collection, and access to the documentation associated with this collection.
So what do those conversations look like? I mean, what happens and what are some of the insights that have come from them?
Well, we've learned so much from this process, and we're still learning because every tribe is different. We really have taken the time to listen, to allow the representatives from the tribe to guide the process rather than us leading that dialogue. For example, with the Pueblo of Zuni, this was a 7-year commitment that SAR and the Pueblo agreed that we would work together to evaluate the 1,000 or so items identified as Zuni, and to work with those tribal representatives from Zuni. In this process, we are learning, or have learned, that what we thought may have been a water jar is actually, based on the collections review, we now know that this particular water jar had an affinity to a particular society within the Pueblo that required other considerations as far as its access and storage and care. So we are trying to be as responsive as we can to those needs that the Pueblo informs us of as to how we should care for these pieces. If it is, in fact, a culturally sensitive item, if it's not repatriated back to the Pueblo, then the Pueblo might ask us to restrict information only to authorized Pueblo officials.
Now, have some items been repatriated, given back to Pueblos?
Yes. We do repatriate. You know, each Pueblo, again, is different. Some will make a claim, and we go through the NAGPRA and repatriation process with them. Other Pueblos will not repatriate, but we work with them to determine the best long-term care for those materials.
The context of everything that we're talking about is colonialism, violence, inequality. And what you're talking about is really turning that around, letting the tribal people lead the conversation. And yet we still have this deep inequality in society that you only have to read the newspaper every 42 seconds to be reminded of. How do you think about really establishing equality? And then what does that look like? Do you find that there are, you know, curators and collectors and scholars who really are letting their minds be changed by what they learn from the people whose cultures they are supposedly experts in?
That's a great question. Our tiny organization is very concerned about all of those things. Our history is one that is rooted in this very Western idea, our ideas. And so we have worked hard in recent years to change the way SAR is viewed by the public, by the tribal communities who are represented in this collection. But beyond that, we are also concerned about how other institutions are addressing these needs and of communities for access to these materials, how they are involving source communities in the curatorial aspects associated with collections. Some institutions have done a great job. Others are still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. I'm trying to kind of imagine how this process goes. And like, you make a 7-year commitment with Zuni Pueblo to have a dialogue. 7 years is a long time, especially when you think about, you know, institutions and project plans. I mean, people don't usually think of a project in those long terms, especially like a 7-year long dialogue. So I'm trying to kind of like put myself, like imagine what that is like. Like, on some level, it's really a process of relationship building, trust building, getting to know each other, and being able to open up in a safe manner. Is that, like, give us just kind of a sense of what happens, like what changes once people do get to know each other?
Well, thank you for asking that question, because that is really the core of all of this, is establishing trust, mutual trust, establishing and understanding what our goals are for this process. It has to be mutually enriching and rewarding. Now, when I say we were working with Zuni for 7 years, and we're currently working with Acoma Pueblo, we are in year 3, we don't have access to these experts based on our calendars. These communities, thankfully, are still observing a cultural calendar.
What do you mean when you say cultural calendar?
Well, they have ceremonies, they have feast days. Okay. There are communal events that happen throughout the year. The seasons observed are very critical, and we would never try to pull them away from those responsibilities. So, you know, these are, again, some of these critical considerations is not forgetting on the institution end that these communities are living, thriving cultural centers. So it's a process of building trust, building a level of understanding that allows us to organize a successful review experience for both the community and SAR.
Now, you were talking about Acoma. You are from Acoma. You are also a potter. You are deeply rooted in that community, and it's funny to like listen to you talk, because you're saying, you know, we at SAR, we at the Indian Arts Center, we at SAR, they, the Pueblo, but you're both. So what's that process like for you? I imagine it helps you really move through the process a lot more smoothly.
The advantage that I have is I'm a fluent speaker. I can engage with our tribal experts in our language. The challenge that produces is interpretation, then, of the process with our non-speaking staff.
Right.
So I often have to just remind myself to turn my English voice on because I think sometimes we end up getting caught up in these really intense conversations in our own language.
Do you tape record them?
Yes, we do. You know, the process with Acoma began before I came to SAR. So I felt really fortunate that I could be part of this review process with representatives from my own community. I think my role, when I put on my Acoma hat, is to remind the Acoma representatives that here is an opportunity to have a conversation that we don't always have at home. And these conversations are very robust.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. And we're just going to take a quick break to tell you that the Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. We've had a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies, but very little moisture, and the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. You can visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. Once again, that's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And now back to our program. We've been talking a lot about process. I'd love to hear, again, about some of the specific things that you've learned. What are some stories that you feel that you can share? What are some, I was here the other day and looking at these pots and looking at some of the art. And I was thinking a lot when I left about, you know, the whole question of what art is in the first place. There have to be some, both some similarities and some real differences between the Western idea of quote-unquote art and Pueblo ideas about art. What are some of those juicy differences and similarities that maybe our listeners don't know?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think there are two ways that this process is informing a public outside of the community. One is specifically to SAR and I, the Indian Arts Research Center, is we've had these materials for a long time. We have learned a tremendous amount from Zuni and Acoma. With Acoma, it's been really interesting with these potters because they have such great memories. And they have been able to identify and create classifications of pottery that we didn't have before this engagement. For example, they have identified a series of pottery that they are confident was made by the same family. And it's a particular design style. The forms are very similar. And they've actually identified the family.
Are they still there? Are they still artists?
There are some potters and descendants of that family who are still actively making pottery. They are able to identify also the makers of some of, you know, there's a potter by the name of Mary Histia. Her nickname at Acoma was Lucky, and they refer to it as Haraki. And she actually named herself. But she was also a very modest individual. You know, there are many pots that she created in collections all over the world. And, you know, while we talk about some of the matriarch potters from Acoma, like Lucy Lewis and Marisi Chino, Jesse Garcia, Juana Lino, and others who really made a name for themselves because they, you know, they really put themselves out there and introduced themselves to the market, Lucky didn't do that. She was at Acoma. She lived a very simple life. She was creating these amazing pots. And they were leaving the community, but not because she was out there marketing her work. So we're learning a lot more about this Mary Histia. And I think as we move forward, we are probably going to follow up with some additional questions to them about these histories of these significant people from the Pueblo. And it wasn't only the potters that, you know, they've talked about the role of the male in the process of pottery making. Historically, when today we have a large number of master potters who are male, and that, you know, the kind of that transition that happened over time. And
was it not a traditionally male?
No, it was not. No. But it's been really interesting to also then hear this narrative of the impacts of men going into World War I and World War II and other subsequent wars, and their experiences in the military, their experiences working in the mines, the uranium mines near Acoma, and how those experiences and the impacts of the closure of those mines and that source of income to families at Acoma shifted this paradigm at Acoma about the males and their access to the clay.
Talk about that more. Like, so men went to war, men worked in the mines closed. How does that relate to clay and being a potter?
Well, a lot of those men who, when returned back to the Pueblo, were unable to find employment. When the mines closed, a lot of those men were left unemployed. And so pottery making happened to be the, I guess, the source of not even creativity, I don't think, for some, but a source of, okay, I need to learn how to make pottery so I can support my family.
Yeah.
You know, I can provide for my family.
Yeah.
And while it was not seen as something appropriate culturally, it happened and eventually became accepted.
What were the gender roles of the various arts? I mean, if traditionally pottery was something that women did, were there specific art forms that were male or exclusively male, or both genders did them?
Yeah, there was a very strong textile tradition at Acoma that is now lost, and it was predominantly male. Males were the weavers. Males were also the basket makers, though there were some women who also made baskets. And that weaving tradition, it's unfortunate that it's been lost. And when I reference the loss of the tradition, it's the large format textiles. We don't have any men in Acoma who are currently weaving large format textiles. We estimate that the last weavers created their textiles in the 1880s.
Do any of them survive?
Oh, yes. There are some in museum collections. We have a few here at SAR. But that weaving tradition is also rooted, at Acoma anyway, in a sensitive cultural context. So, you know, that knowledge, that traditional knowledge associated with that tradition is lost.
One of the things that's interesting to me about, again, this conversation between West and Pueblo ways of thinking and approaching art, quote-unquote art, is, I mean, the Western tradition is so, at least the last maybe several centuries, individual. So you have the great artist, you have the genius, you've got Picasso, you've got Dali, and there's ego in it as well as genuine creativity. Pueblo mind, or Pueblo ways of going about life, as far as I understand, are more about the collective than the individual. So it's not about, you know, I'm Brian, the great artist. It's like, I am part of something bigger. And yet, you know, there's the market. I mean, at a certain point, people started making things for the market, as you talk about. And we know about Maria Martinez, and we know people who've got big names, and that, you know, that commands more money. So how are we to understand this? How do we think about that? How do you kind of live in both worlds?
It's really interesting that in most Native American communities, indigenous communities, we don't have a name or a word for art. You know, there are references to someone who is talented with their hands, and the creation of textiles or ceramics, jewelry, are also rooted in this kind of cultural understanding of materials provided to us by the creator. A landscape, a rich landscape provided to us by the creator, and taking from the resource to create something beautiful, whether it be adornment, personal adornment, or something ceremonial, or something utilitarian, are the basis for how we understand what we call art today. you know, there are many things that, as a result of contact and certainly a result of the influence of Western culture, that have shifted these or maybe advanced to this understanding and offered us the opportunity to think about these things that we create from our natural environment as art. It's really the market, the art market, the Native American art market that really drives this. So today, you know, we have many talented Native American artists who are part of this art movement. And the way I think about it is we are still fulfilling, you know, this inherent responsibility to preserve our culture. And if it's doing it through painting on a canvas or creating a bronze sculpture, making a film or a documentary, or by writing a beautiful poem, we are fulfilling that inherent responsibility. And that influence is much more far-reaching. It's something that is personal. It's something that maybe impacts our families, supports our families, but it impacts a much larger audience. And if that can continue, you know, to prove Edgar Lee Hewitt and others wrong again, We'll be here. We'll continue to be here. And that these art forms will continue to manifest themselves. And many tribes have expressed the concern for the materials. If we are respectful to these natural materials, then they will continue to provide for us. However, if we don't, then we might see some challenges. We've already experienced some challenges relative to access to the quality clays, the best minerals, the best pieces of wood. So we have to do our part. And I hope that's what the larger world understands, is that indigenous communities work very hard every day to sustain themselves and to sustain these cultures, even while there's all of this influence. And the Indian Arts Research Center, through our artist fellowship programs, through these collections review processes, through symposia, we bring these tribal people, tribal representatives together to talk about some of these critical issues and shared concerns.
What are your hopes for this work as you continue to unfold it and these dialogues with tribal people continue? And what have been for you some of the most exciting and fulfilling parts of it for you personally?
I have to commend my predecessors here at SAR and in the Indian Arts Research Center for staying true to the mission. There was a reason for amassing this collection. Maybe it wasn't rooted in the needs of the tribes. It wasn't. But here we are. We have this collection, 12,000 items of Southwest Native American art. And so it needs to be accessible. It needs to be allowed to influence conversation, research, be a support system to the source communities. And I think ultimately the institution must always work towards being the better steward. What I am really grateful to see happening is the recognition of this work by institutions throughout the country who are coming to us and asking for guidance, who are asking for our opinion on their proposed projects, exhibits, or ideas around engagement with source communities. Our guidelines have become recognized as a resource for both communities, but I think more so for museums. And it isn't only museums. We are finding that our guidelines are now being utilized by the corporate sector. So it's great that the work that we have engaged in and have worked so hard to achieve are having an impact.
I came here several days ago and you were talking about there are really different ideas about conservation that maybe some tribes have versus institutions have. So you've got a pot and maybe it's broken or a little broken. What are some of those differences?
Yeah, there are some interesting things we've learned in this process, because one of the questions we ask in the review process is, how do we address the conservation needs of the collections? It's very different for each category of collections and ranges from one tribe to the next. For example, with Acoma, they have made it very clear that if we have condition issues with a particular ceramic, any ceramic, that it be left as is.
You don't try to fix it.
We don't try to fix it. However, they are also very interested to know what technology is available to reconstruct a damaged ceramic, for example. So we are introducing the potters through our partnerships with the Museum of New Mexico Conservation Lab and others to inform the potters of other options and using technology to achieve that reconstruction or repair of a particular ceramic.
But it sounds like you're saying two things. Both they want repair techniques and they say you shouldn't repair it.
Yeah, the physical piece needs to maintain its current condition. And there are cultural reasons for that.
The Indian Arts Research Center is celebrating its 40th anniversary on Friday the 22nd of June at 6 o'clock at the Poe Cultural Center at Pauqui Pueblo. What's going to happen there? Is the public invited? Can everybody who's listening to this come if they want to?
Yeah, it's a big celebration. And some might ask, why 40 years? Why are you celebrating 40 years? One of the things that we thought about was, you know, the number 4 is significant to most Native American and indigenous cultures. You know, sometimes it's in reference to the directions or cycles, seasons. The number 4 has great significance within communities and Pueblo culture and other indigenous cultures. So we thought, 40, let's celebrate the 40. This facility was built 40 years ago, and it's the time when the Indian Arts Fund Collection moved into the space. This would become its permanent home. And we've achieved a lot over that 40 years. We've hosted a total of 75 Native American artists from all over the country during this time. And we've hosted, I think, close to 50 interns and have held a number of events that have offered engagement by our source communities with the collections. There have been a number of publications about the collections, and many of these materials have left our vaults for exhibit. And so we want to commemorate that, and the event on the 22nd next month is to celebrate these achievements. And this year, we also are awarding Nora Naranjo Moores of Santa Clara Pueblo with a Lifetime Achievement Award. It's a ticketed event. It is a fundraiser, with all proceeds benefiting the programming here at the Indian Arts Research Center. It would include a reception at the Poe Center. Folks who are coming to the event will have access to view the exhibits at the Poe Center, visit the Tower at Roxanne Swensel's Tower Gallery, and we have a Native American chef who is offering some tasty hors d'oeuvres. We'll have a signature cocktail for our guests and a silent auction with artwork that have been donated by some of our former artist fellows. And the main program will include some presentations as well as the Lifetime Achievement Award. The event is being emceed by another former artist fellow, and that's Robert Mirabal of Taos Pueblo. And then we'll have a live auction featuring 8 items, including a pot by Lonnie V. Hill from Nambe Pueblo, a basket by Carol E. Marthley Douglas, also a former artist fellow, Kathleen Wall, to name a few. And then we will end the night with some music and dancing by Native Roots. It's a reggae band out of Santa Ana Pueblo.
Talking about cultural collaboration.
Oh, yeah. And the evolution of arts.
Yeah.
So we're very excited, and we hope that folks will join us for this festive occasion, and our work continues.
And people can get tickets through the SAR website, which is sarweb.org. Can people tour? Are there opportunities for people to see the collection here at the Indian Arts Research Center?
Yes, we do offer public tours every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. And beginning in early June through the end of September, we also offer a Wednesday tour at 2 o'clock.
And ladies and gentlemen, you will be very happy if you do so. because it's quite a collection. It's, in fact, kind of overwhelming to see all these objects together, and it must be that way for the people from, as you say, source communities to come in and see all these things together.
It is. It's overwhelming every day when I walk into this office and look through that vault door and see the open storage and see all the materials. That's, it's like having your first cup of coffee in the morning. It's invigorating.
Brian Vaio is director of the Indian Arts Research Center at the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.